Michael Hirsch over at the National Journal reported something from a senior State Department official that's got a little bit of talk, but not much. But it really just, it made me go back to that October of 2000. Here was the quote, as reported by Michael Hirsch again. Quote, "The war on terror is over," unquote, one senior State Department official who works on the Middle East issues told me. Now, going back to the quote, "Now that we've killed most of al-Qaeda, now that people have come to see legitimate means of expression, people who once might have gone into al-Qaeda see opportunity for legitimate Islamism," unquote. And I think we'll eventually get to those deeper thoughts, but that's really not the reason we brought our guest on today. Our guest is Commander Kirk Lippold, U.S. Navy retired. He was a commanding officer of the USS Cole, DDG 67, at the time of her attack on the 12th of October, 2000, in the port of Aden, Yemen. He also is the author of a new book called Front Runner, Al-Qaeda's Attack on the USS Cole. Kirk, welcome back to Midrats.
Great to be back on the show. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Kirk. I think and you know, we can get to larger issues later on, but I think discussions I've had with some people offline and around a beer who involved and have great affection for the Navy and our history, not just the history in the past, but the history that's being made right now, and how important it is for those who either by accident of history or by acts of their own find themselves at a critical point, that they write. They write about what they see. They write about what they learned, what they've experienced, and tell that first-person report. And along those lines, first of all, thank you for writing the book. We do not have enough, I don't think, first-hand reporting of events nowadays. And I think this will do great things to add to people's knowledge base and perhaps flesh out some corners that haven't been covered well. But it has been a little over 11 and a half years since the attack on your ship. If you could, for a minute, just from an author's perspective and somebody who obviously has a lot of personally invested in this, what brought you to this journey where a little more than a decade later we now have a book out? And what do you think that adds to an understanding of the attack that may not have been there if you had published a book earlier in last decade?
Well, that's a great question. And for me, I initially started to write it back in 2002. I had found a publisher, I had gotten together with an author, and it was going to be one of those classic Kirk Lippold with someone, where I would do a series of interviews, they would do the writing, we'd put out a book, it'd be great. And I ultimately decided that it was the wrong time and wrong place. We were at war. I was assigned to the Joint Staff at that point. I was still proud to be contributing to the defense of our nation as the war was in full swing at that point. And I don't know exactly why, but I knew that this was not the right time. And I'm so thankful that I did that, because in the intervening years till I really sat down at the keyboard, starting in early 2010, what I learned is that people were quiet. They were content to let it kind of be relegated to obscurity. The Navy was just as content not to really talk about it. They wanted to take particular lessons learned and apply them, and others just ignore. And I also discovered a unique phenomenon. The crew and the families were feeling like the event, lost in the shadow of 9/11, was not getting the attention it deserved. So I made a commitment, reached out to a number of the crew over time, even some families, some senior government officials, including Ambassador Bodine, Admiral Natter, Admiral Moore, who was Fifth Fleet at the time, and they were willing now to talk, because they realized that a book that I would have written 8 years ago might have been perceived as having an agenda or an axe to grind, whereas the book I wrote now is a very open, very honest recollection from my unique vantage point as captain, and I think it is much richer in the detail and the descriptions, because people were willing to share in many cases, especially with the crew, their inner thoughts with me that up until then they had been somewhat reluctant to do. Everyone had kind of moved on, but now they wanted that moment in our nation's history captured for posterity.
Before we, I read your book, and I think it's really excellent. Everybody who's served in the Navy or is interested in serving the Navy or has an interest in national security ought to read it. One of my questions that I want to start off with is the difference, the lines that are drawn between the responsibility, accountability, and the CO's job. Can you kind of run through that so people be reminded of how complex that can be?
Absolutely. The way I've always viewed it is when it, in the case of USS Cole, accountability for a commanding officer at sea is absolute. On the morning of October 12, 2000, there was one accountable officer on that ship, and that was me. When that ship was attacked, the only thing I ever asked in the ensuing investigations is that they look at the performance of my ship and crew before, during, and after that attack. When you look at responsibility, and there is a lot of people like to think that accountability and responsibility are the same. They're not. There's a difference between accountability and what people and standards they are held to. Responsibility is where you're looking for an assignment of both well done, but occasionally and a lot of times, blame. I was not responsible for that attack. Osama bin Laden, who coming up on the 1 year anniversary on Tuesday, he was the guy that put in motion the pieces that would eventually all line up over a period of time through intelligence failures, training and readiness failures, would ultimately result in us being in that port as the 27th ship to pull in there, where we went in blind, and unfortunately, we got nailed. And I don't point fingers at anyone. I like to look at it and say, look, we just didn't know what we didn't know. And when you look at accountability, how my ship performed, I am still proud of to this day. If you look at responsibility for how that attack occurred, it squarely rests with Osama bin Laden, and that's where he should be blamed.
And Kirk, occasionally we get some callers here. We have caller Mark on the line from area code 301. Mark, you have a question for Kirk.
A question and a couple comments. Kirk, this is the Mark you know, Mark Vandroff from old shipmate of yours. And first, I just want to congratulate you on an absolutely wonderful book. I was enthralled the entire time that I was reading Front Burner. And I had forgotten just how many people personally I knew who had either been on the Cole or in the cases of Pat Keene, who had been the diver there. It was a real page turner of the group that was there on that day. And you did a fabulous job paying tribute to your crew, Kirk.
Well, thank you, Mark. I appreciate that.
And the other thing I wanted to mention before I had two questions is I actually read it during the final contract trials of DDG 111 Spruance. And walking around the ship on the Spruance as I was reading your book, it was interesting to see all the lessons learned we had learned from Cole and the different things on the DDGs we're building today that are changed for the better because of the lessons we learned that day. So that part of your crew sacrifice will not go unfulfilled, as it were.
Well, that's heartening to hear because, there's always a little luck that plays into these things, and there were quite a few times where what was luck for us is going to be good, solid planning for the people that have that equipment and on board their ships today, thanks to guys like you that are out there building them for us.
So anyway, but I'm going to ask you a couple of, and I know there will probably be other callers that are going to want to talk about the geostrategic situation that you found yourself in, but I want to ask a couple of DDG geek questions. And the first one is, you talk in the book when you fuel that three generator was fuel starved twice and the reaction to that. After the first time, it didn't come through in the book, was it a problem of the fuel transfer system in keeping the head tank full, or was because of the damage, was the crew having trouble getting accurate soundings of the generator head tank?
What Mark is referring to is when we were running the generator the fourth night on Saturday night going into Sunday morning, the generator quit. We quickly determined it was because of fuel starvation, not because the generator was eating itself. But It came from the measurements into the head tank. We had no way to remotely monitor our fuel levels. The only way we were doing it was by sounding the tank and then trying to guess as good as possible where those soundings were, because we were also, we had the problem where we were guesstimating based upon the kilowatt load what the burn rate was and guesstimating where the 50% point was, and we just misjudged. And
okay.
We finally had to learn to increase those things by a massive amount of percentage until we could get it to a point to where we were not able to lose the generator again. But unfortunately, a few days after we got all that figured out and ironed out and we're doing it right, we had a Class Charlie fire in the number 3 switchboard that resulted in the generator not being able to connect to the board and therefore could not power the ship, and that's when we had to shift to number 2 generator.
Right. And it would be an interesting engineering analysis that a damaged generator is going to run at a much less efficient than a generator than its pristine state.
Yeah, I mean, for all the listeners out there, when we were shifting and cleaning lube oil strainers for number 3 generator, when we were pulling the magnets out of the basket, each time the magnets were covered in fuzz because the generator, flexing from the force of the explosion over a period of days, knowing that material was in there, we knew it was a matter not of if we were going to lose 3 generator, but when we were going to lose it, and that's why we were so desperate to get number 2 up. My greatest concern was I wanted to keep the crew together and on board the ship, and if I knew that we had lost a generator, couldn't power, A, we might lose the ship, but B, it would split the crew and they'd start going out to hotels and it would just give an excuse to break down that unity of command, which is so important in a crisis situation like this.
The second question, and this was a curiosity, and it didn't come through in the book, or maybe I didn't follow it as well. As you got underway from Aden to head out to the Blue Marlin, you mentioned you were able to get a shaft operable and able to answer bells on one of your shafts, but you were also being towed. During the transit out to Blue Marlin, did you end up having to use that shaft at all? Did you put any kind of pitch on the shaft, or was it strictly there as a standby?
No, what the engineers were able to do was we were able to jack the shaft around so that we knew we had free and clear rotation of the shaft itself. We were able to start 2 alpha main engine, and we were able to demonstrate that we could, in fact, through cold checks, clutch it in and out if necessary. But once we knew we were going to get towed out, knowing if we could use that shaft in an absolute emergency, we had to jack that shaft into the docking position and lock it into place, simply because we were very concerned about any drag going across the blades during that tow down the 23 miles down the coast of Yemen to get to where the Blue Marlin was anchored. We could not afford to have that shaft rotate.
Yep. So, well, those are going to be your two DDG engineering geek questions for the.
Mark, it doesn't surprise me coming from you that you would ask those kinds of technical questions.
But thanks for the book, and I'm looking forward to the rest of the hour. And for Sal, thank you very much for having Kirk as your guest this hour.
Thanks, Mark.
Mark, thank you very much for the call. I was about to light a cigar, pour a drink, kick my feet back, and let you do the rest of the show. That was a great couple of questions. Mark, you can call in anytime. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mark did his question just kind of really piqued one of my pet hobby horses is, and what you touched on is perfect in this regard. Our brothers and sisters in the Army and the Marine Corps, through the course of 10 years of sometimes very heavy but low-intensity conflict, they've had to relearn some fundamentals that anybody from World War II, Korea, or Vietnam would have said, what do you mean you're not doing this? Because nothing will validate or invalidate a concept or procedure more than combat. And everything from putting RPG cages around to the utility of something larger than a 5.56 millimeter round in your squad. But the Air Force, but especially the Navy, the coal was attacked. We've hit some mines during the Gulf War. We can look back of what is now becoming a very long time ago to the Falklands about some of the realities of keeping a warship, if not able to fight hurt, at least to stay afloat, to get back, to be repaired. And you mentioned earlier about there were some lessons learned that the Navy has adjusted, and Mark brought that up with what the good people are doing with the new USS Bruins and other DDGs to incorporate the lessons that your crew earned in their lives and their blood. But you also mentioned there were some lessons out there that perhaps we haven't taken on board. What would be the top one or two things that you don't feel that the Navy as an institution has really taken on board based upon the experience of your crew?
Well, I'll tell you, when we got hit, my number one priority, as it should be, was to save the ship. My number two priority was the triage effort for the crew to make sure that we could get the wounded stabilized and to better treatment facilities. In our case, we were able to get them to hospitals ashore. My number three priority is I'm standing in the middle of the triage area, and it happened at about the 40-minute point, was water. I knew that unless we could get and keep the crew hydrated with water, not sodas, not Gatorade, not Red Bull, but water, that we were not going to be able to survive. The Navy today still believes that you can get by on 1 quart per person per day. That's absolutely true if you are in a static environment. We were in the middle of a major damage control effort that was going to last beyond hours and possibly days. It was going to be intensive. We were dealing with over 100-degree heat and about 80-plus percent humidity, and people were literally sweating out that fluid at a point that if I could not keep them hydrated, it wouldn't matter how badly I wanted to save the ship or crew, we were going to lose them. Today, the Navy has made no effort for alternative means to keep a crew watered, i.e. using buckets out of the harbor if necessary and shoving them through hand filters to be able to get water if you don't have it on board, to be able to keep it so the crew can continue to drink and keep fighting to save their ship.
Throughout the book, you could refer to World War II type approaches to damage control that were caused by the damage to your particular ship, and some of those included the use of messengers to run damage control messages. I mean, the kind of thing I used to do back in the 70s on board a ship. But one of the questions I had is you had 250 or so crew members on this ship. How were and you were quite your crew was quite well trained and able to save the ship on a vessel the size of an LCS with a much smaller crew. Are they looking at just walking away if they get this kind of damage? What would your view of that be?
I am becoming increasingly concerned that the Navy is, because of purely budgetary concerns, is becoming overly enamored with this reduced manning and automation of systems. Reduced manning, the reality is if you were to take an LCS and immediately lose 20% of your crew, which is about what we lost between the wounded and injured and people that needed to go ashore to help with some of the wounded as they left the ship, the reality of it is I'm not sure they could survive a sustained damage control effort. A one-on hit where they can contain the damage and do it over a period of a couple hours, yes, they can survive. If you have an ongoing damage control effort like we were trying to do, where we were doing not only maintaining damage control but trying to get systems restoration, because we had, of course, no power in the forward two-thirds of the ship. We were sleeping outside under the stars for the first 5 days. I am very concerned that we're not going to be able to do it. And this reliance that we're coming down to on automation works great if it works. The problem is, with something as simple as a hit like we took, and I shouldn't say simple, it was a very, very big explosion, but my 1MC failed, and the battery backup failed for reasons that even today remained unexplained with what the IVIX, the internal voice communication system. The data multiplexing cables were supposed to have been run two up the port side and one up the starboard. Well, through a shipyard flaw, they all ran up the port side. Those are things that are beyond the ship's force capability to have a say in or be able to do. All we can do is react to them. I didn't have the automation available to me. I know that there was a move afoot even a few years ago to pull all the damage control plates off because you're going to have these wonderful plasma displays that you can work off of. What if they don't work?
That's
the question. If they don't work, and automation, if it can fail, it will fail. It is very rarely that a piece of plastic and a grease pencil are going to fail.
I was just having visions of plasma panels and the internal design of plasma panels, and then a hit like your ship took, and somebody who thinks that a plasma I'm sorry, I hadn't heard that little jewel, but that's a great way to get sailors killed. I'd like to pull up a question Claude in the chat room brought in, because it also folds into one of the interesting comments in your book. Which again, if people are interested in the book, you can find a link at the show page and also on my home blog and any of the other places that we've advertised the show if you wanted to go grab Kirk's book. But the you mentioned right after the attack that in your stateroom, in your safe, you had your the keys to all the weapons on the ship, including your you had access to your Sig Sauer and your three magazines. And then you had the weapons in the small arms locker issued. And small arms training has gotten a lot better since 9/11 especially. I'm a little bit of a nut in this respect. I still think we can do more, but it's better than what it used to be. But for a small locker on board of our warships, have there been any appreciable effort to make sure that that is really where it needs when you have a warship like yours in an isolated location that might have a follow-on attack? Are there weapons in the small arms locker that maybe should be in there that is not? And ships, let's face it, you know, the Cole is a pretty nice-sized ship, and eventually a Marine Security Detachment was assigned to your ship after it was attached. Should there be a look at bringing Marine security attachments back on board major surface combatants, or is there something we could do internally in the Navy to maybe up our personal weapons ability to defend ourselves?
Well, I'm one of those guys that say, you know, I always follow the mantra that, you know, solve the problem, not the symptom. And if you have one security locker that you think is going to be available in a time of an emergency, it won't be. And so having multiple lockers with multiple weapons and a variety in each of them spread throughout a ship, and I don't care what size it is, it may just be smaller lockers with fewer weapons because you've got a smaller ship, I think they still need a distributed system on there. So that would be number one regarding where the weapons go. I'm like you. If you're going to train, you train for reality. You don't train for practice. I mean, I grew up in the days where ships received their nuclear weapons qualification, and there was no screwing around when it came to the security alert team, the backup alert force, and the reserve force. It wasn't fun and games. You are dealing with life-threatening, serious consequences if somebody were to attempt to get a nuclear weapon on a ship. I think we need to treat that in the same manner when it comes to terrorists and boarding operations today, because just one person getting aboard and loose with a bandolier of weapons that they have managed to get past the quarterdeck by shooting people can wreak havoc on the interior of a ship, and we need to be prepared to deal with those kinds of situations.
Well, one of the other questions that you addressed at the start of the book, but you ended up in Aden because, as I understood from what you wrote, that there was a shortage of fleet oilers available to the fifth fleet area, so you couldn't refuel at sea. They sent you into Aden to top up. How realistic is the requirement that you keep 50% of fuel on board, and are we short of fleet refueling capacity that would have prevented or helped prevent such an attack?
Absolutely. I mean, if you go back and look at history, we were finishing World War II with a Navy of 4,000 ships. At the height of the Reagan buildup, we were just shy of 400 or 600 ships in 1986. And by the morning of October 12th, we're at 315 ships in the Navy. There was one oiler in the region. And the morning we pulled in, we were below 50% fuel. Navy ships, you know, we like to stay around 60 to 70%. And a recent example of that is just look at the Bainbridge and the great operation she did with Maersk Alabama and having to rescue Captain Phillips. You cannot have a ship out on station for days and days on end unless they have the ability to stay topped off at sea and be able to stay there. I mean, we can't untie that pirate boat and tell them, sit still for 6 hours while I go do an unrep over the horizon, and then we'll be back to hook you back up and pull you in to take out the pirates. The reason why we stay topped off and the reason why we need more oilers at sea is because logistics is life. If we can't sustain ourselves at sea where we have a, not a virtual presence, but a real presence on our strategic sea lanes around the globe, then we are surrendering our capability to defend not only our citizens, but our economic interests as well.
I think what's interesting, the conversation we've had in the last 10 to 15 minutes about damage control and the ability to logistically maintain yourself, there's been, in addition to our shrinking fleet, there's been an ongoing discussion, a guest we've had and a friend of the show, Captain Henry J. Hendricks, Jr., otherwise known as Jerry. I don't know if you're familiar with his work on influence squadrons and, you know, buying Fords, not Ferrari, which is one of the articles in Proceedings he punched out there that really got a conversation going. But, and I'm not an opponent of the idea. I like a lot of those concepts, but his influence squadrons and his Fords, not Ferraris, we're talking about smaller ships. We're talking about engagement and non-first or second world nations like Yemen. These are smaller units, spending lots of times in harbors. But all this discussion about engagement, visiting small ships, influence squadrons, many times seems to be in a very sterile environment when you look at the attacks, especially in the Fifth Fleet AOR, that we've had on our Navy in a variety of ways. Is there a certain utility to, like was done for most of our Navy's history, that when you did engagement operations and you showed the flag, they usually were done by small ships. They were done by destroyers, cruisers. Is there a utility in having engagements done with ships the size of an Arleigh Burke, even though the nations we're visiting don't have the capacity to be at that level, if for no other reason that in many times size matters?
I think you have to do a combination of both. I think by having the small ships, it is demonstrating that we have the not only the capability but the capacity to work with navies their size or coast guards in the case of like a country like Yemen. But having a capital ship in there, like a cruiser, also sends a signal that we are willing to safeguard our economic interests, our national interests, in strategic sea lanes, in the blue water nation, and that also can serve their nation's interest as well by keeping those strategic sea lanes open. So I think it has to be a combination of both. You can't go one with the other, but anytime you have engagement where a Navy ship pulls in, the crew members go out and they are engaging with local society, whether it is doing tours and just talking to local populace, or whether you are getting involved with operations like Operation Hand Clasp, where you're turning over material or you're doing work at local orphanages or other community service activities in a country. Each of those in their small way makes a difference. Each of those in a small way shows that we are not afraid to go out into the communities, engage, that we want to view these countries as partners in safeguarding, but also in helping them by working with them to teach them how to safeguard their economic interests within first their territorial waters, and then beyond that, if they get the capability to do it, out to the edge of their economic exclusive zone, where they've got a lot of countries, especially off the coast of Africa, have vital fishing interests that are being pillaged these days by other countries around the world who realize that these countries don't have the capability to defend themselves.
When you when the coal transited the Red Sea through the and the Suez Canal, you had moved from 6th Fleet into the 5th Fleet AOR. And as I understand, what happened was that there apparently was a disconnect in the messages you were receiving about what readiness condition you should have been at or should have maintained as you made that transition. Can you kind of describe what happened, and is that problem still existent, or as a result of what happened to the coal, has that been changed?
Well, there were two things that were happening at the same time. One was they were trying to transition to a new matrix for quantifying threats within the theater, and there was some misunderstanding, and the fact that we were going from a 5-tier system to a 4-tier system, which, you know, both the XO and I kind of said, well, we're not there yet, but based upon what they're saying, it appears that there is a decrease in the overall level of the threat rather than doing that. The other one that you refer to is that while we were operating in the 6th Fleet AOR, there was a message sent out that said, beware of a small boat threat by Al-Qaeda. But it didn't tell what kind of small boat threat. You know, you got to remember back in that mindset pre-9/11, if you had told me small boat threat on the morning of October 11th, I would have thought in terms of a small boat coming at me that was going to attack with 50 cals and rocket-propelled grenades. But what happened is we received that message in 6th Fleet. Once I chopped through the Suez Canal and headed into the 5th Fleet, that threat, which was specific to 6th Fleet, was now in my rearview mirror. What I did not know, and it was because of how they were structuring the in-theater briefings, is that that message had been picked up by 6th or by 5th Fleet, retransmitted out and said, while this may be in the 6th Fleet AOR, Al-Qaeda is operational in our theater, beware. I mean, that was just essentially the gist. But that never got to us because we were supposed to come refuel and then head around the corner and through the Strait of Hormuz and pull into Bahrain 4 days later, and we would get all of our in-theater briefings. That's when that message would have been included in our in-theater briefing package, but we never got there. And I think that even today, I am concerned with the scope and depth of briefings that ships get as they transit between theaters to ensure that there are no intelligence gaps. I keep getting the impression with talking from the SEALs on the waterfront that intelligence, once again, is beginning to focus its needs upward and not down to that actual CO who has to make those critical decisions about what to do and not to do to force protect their ship.
I share your concern, Kirk. And I just, every time I made a Suez transit, you know, you talk about your seams. I get the willies just thinking about how lucky we've been every time we do a Suez transit. And when you look, you know, we've been doing a very naval professional centric discussion so far, as it should be. But when you back up and bring in some other disciplines and you look at the date October of 2000, everything the military does is in one way or another shaded by politics. And I wonder if you could take for a minute and talk about your thoughts on how politics may have played in to the decision of requiring you to go into Aden with the upcoming 2000 election. And also, were there some issues with Senator Warner involved with this that the listener might be interested in?
Sure. When you look at the politics, the reality is we, despite the knowledge within the intelligence community that Yemen had active terrorist cells, specifically with Al-Qaeda, operating within their country, that there were Al-Qaeda cells potentially in Aden, although we weren't picking anything up. There were some, you know, some tidbits here and there to indicate that they were using that port to monitor U.S. ships and gather intelligence. The ambassador in the country, in conjunction with the Central Command commander at the time, General Zinni, felt that we could have an engagement policy and that that port would serve two purposes. One, we could go in there to buy fuel, which introduces money into their economy in that local area, and begin to work with the local Navy district commander and others to show that we are good partners in that area of the world. And the same token, diplomatically, it showed that we believed that we trusted the Yemeni government and President Saleh, that we could put our ships in there and that they would be properly looked after and safeguarded. The reality of it is nobody was communicating the threat that was there. Nobody in the intelligence services appreciated what was going on. We had zero human intelligence assets from the CIA's perspective in that port telling us what to do. So when NCIS would go there to do a port vulnerability assessment, who would they be asking? They'd be talking to the locals. They would talk to the folks at the embassy, but they're relying on our national intelligence assets to tell them whether or not that port's safe. So the picture that was being built was a picture that was not based on the actual conditions on the ground, but what we believed based upon what we were being told, and the perception of safety was not a reality as we pulled in there. But satisfying the political needs within that country became the overriding priority, which is why, despite the fact that the embassy up in the capital that shut down because of terrorist threat and was shut down on the day that we pulled in and the ambassador had gone back to Washington for consultations, we still blithely pulled in there blind like it was just another normal day. So politics driving national security interests can have huge ramifications that the Navy unfortunately had to deal with after October 12th.
You talked a little bit about the training for the deployment, and one aspect of it was some kind of counter-terrorist thing, but it was a shoreside attack. Was there any, and is there now, if you can tell me, any effort given to defending against the red teaming assaults from the water side?
Yes, the Navy has done a very credible job, I think, in trying to create scenarios where you do have a waterborne threat that attempts to come near a ship. Again, the whole issue becomes what intelligence is the commanding officer getting on board that ship that is allowing them to make a determination to say, okay, is this just somebody that is wants to come up and take a close look at our vessel, or is this someone who intends to do us harm? Or are they just kind of testing us for something that may happen two ports from now? This is where, again, it comes back to the intelligence community and the analysts helping build a picture for those COs that are out there so that they have that sense, so that they have that feel of what is actually the conditions going on, that situational awareness, whether it's in a port or operating off the coast of a nation where there are fishing boats around and everything else, whether or not they have a terrorist group might have the capability and capacity to come attack us.
And kind of a little different subject, and it might be an uncomfortable subject for you, but it's something that is raised in the book, and I think it's something that everybody that has served can relate to, is when you deal with people on an individual basis, people have their own particular personalities, their own particular ways they do businesses. But it also becomes real apparent that individual ships and commands have their own culture, their own personalities, and sometimes they can be so strong they will transcend commanding officers, where you can visit a ship and 1 year, come back 3 years, and three COs later, and that culture is still there, though perhaps nuanced, changed a little bit. If you could, please, take a minute to discuss the Tarawa and how she treated the Cole and Aiden and how those cultures may have been perhaps a little different than what you think they would be.
Well, that's a very tough one. I really debated and was not initially I was not going to put the incident with Tarawa in the book. But when I went to the 10-year anniversary and I was talking with the crew, when you brought up that ship, the reaction by my crew was visceral. They were still angry, is the only way to put it. And just so your listeners understand, what had happened is we had had folks from Tarawa come aboard the ship. They were helping us. But by the same token, we also experienced the number, unfortunately, of thefts of personal gear, mostly the patches off of uniforms, belt buckles, ball caps. And I still believe, wrongly for them, that they were trying to get a piece of history. But it was just disappointing that that would happen. I don't know why a culture like that gets created. I'm one of those that very early on in my career as a brand new ensign on a ship, we had a thief in one of our divisions on board. And I will tell you right now, until that individual was caught, that a thief in your midst is one of the most corrosive forces you can have. Because a lot of times people forget, when you're at sea, you are relying on everyone else around you with your life. You have to make sure that those people, regardless of whether they like you, dislike you, hate you, or love you, it isn't going to matter in a time of crisis, whether it's a fire, flooding, or explosion. You have to have that inner trust that you can rely on them to do what's necessary to save your life, and that they know they can rely on you to save theirs. And when you have somebody like a thief on board the ship, it makes a world of difference, because now you're putting that shred of doubt into people's mind, and in a combat effective unit, you cannot afford that.
Let me talk a little bit on the more positive side of some things. You talked right before the show started about this book being about a crew of heroes. Could you expand on that?
Absolutely, yes. I mean, when you look at what those sailors did that morning, I tell folks all the time, still today, when I go out and do some speaking about the event, you know, people will complain about, oh, the young kids today, they're not plugged in, they don't give it. I don't buy that for one second. I believe that these young men and women today, just like I had with my crew, they raise their right hand. They choose a life of consequence and service to their nation. Those young men and women that walked on board Cole that I was privileged enough to command, I just set a high standard. They went to work at meeting it. They were rewarded for doing great. They did absolutely phenomenal. And when we got hit with, as I mentioned earlier in the show, with the 1MC down and the alarm systems not working, nobody to tell them what to do, where to go, what had happened. They fell back on their training. There was no panic. No one was running through the passageway screaming, oh my God, the ship's going to sink and we're all going to die. There was a calm, focused effort. The damage control teams immediately went out, assessed the damage, and began to do what was necessary to keep the ship afloat. Those not involved in the damage control effort came down out of their darkened GQ stations in the forward part of the ship and formed the core of the triage effort. We were able to evacuate 33 wounded off the ship that first day. They did it in 99 minutes, and of those 33, 32 had survived. The ship itself was stable within that first day, within 1 to 2 hours. And then it was a matter of beginning immediately into systems restoration, trying to figure out how to get power to communications, how to get light strung forward, how to be able to restore fan coil units. And we worked all those things. Sunday morning, when the only operating generator quit, and we went through casualty after casualty after casualty, where high pressure air doesn't restart the generator, the emergency diesel standby that was down on the pier would not start, when the fact that we couldn't cut a hole in the side of the ship because the PECU batteries were dead, the portable exothermic cutting unit batteries were dead, and that eventually you're relying on sailor ingenuity by using the portable high-pressure air compressors that we use for the breathing apparatus for the firefighting teams, but instead charging the flask for the generator. All those things come together to show you that in times of crisis, people that are trained properly and know what they're doing truly become the heroes that they are. And guess what? Last Monday, USS Cole redeployed again for the fifth time since the attack to go back and safeguard those sea lanes. It is because of the heroes that I had that morning on board the ship that USS Cole's afloat today.
And I couldn't agree with you more, Kirk. Whenever somebody, especially somebody in uniform, makes some comment about the young sailors we have, and that's one of the things I miss, being that I retired 2 years ago, is interacting with this generation of young men and women. They're a great group. I'm glad I'm not competing against a lot of them.
I'll tell you right now, when I get those same comments, if it's more of a private audience, I'll look at them and say, feel free to lead.
Yeah.
Because it's not those young sailors that are failing, it's you.
That's an absolute fact. Our nation is in very good hands if we can just get the right leaders to help make the best of them. If this is a great generation of young men and women, we're more than fine. But that's what I wanted to ask you about is leadership in crisis, in the fact that when a ship takes a major casualty, your diagrams and your LPOs and your chiefs, they might not be with us anymore. They may not be able to get where they're needed the most, but you need to develop a culture and develop leaders of action where we're at a situation, something needs to be done, I'm not going to wait for somebody to show up and do it. I want to take charge with the people I can grab and move forward. Obviously, training is an absolute huge part of that, and it does do the foundation for the motor memory and knowing what to do and where to go. But you also have to have that culture of leadership and knowing when it's your time to lead, and that seamless transition from need to action. What are things that not just commanding officers, but those new JGs that are just putting on their SWO pin, what can they do to help build that culture of action and leadership inside their areas of responsibility on their ship?
I would tell you there's a number of things they need to do. There's no one thing that is going to be the magic tool that they can use to make that happen. I mean, the first thing that I always try to operate and tell people with is you have to make sure that you always make the right decision for the right reason at the right time, regardless of the consequences, and it boils down to a word that we talk about and give lip service to, but you have to live by it, and that's integrity. If you do that, you will always be able to operate truthfully and to the best of your ability. You have to have that ability also to tell people, look, there's only one person in your life that makes you make a decision. That's you. You can have rules, regulations, peer pressure, but the reality of it is there's only one person responsible for their decisions and their actions, and that's the individual. When people begin to realize that they are responsible for the decisions they make, they begin to realize that they are controlling their own destiny. And what happens from that is sailors look to their left and their right, they realize that the guys and gals standing next to them can make the right decision for the right reasons because they know they're doing it not only for themselves but their shipmates, and that fosters that teamwork. And that's what every one of us like to have happen without us saying it. And then you need to trust and invest in your people. You know, I'm one of those guys that says I don't like the word empower. Empower just means you want somebody to do something that you didn't want to do in the first place, and when they don't get it right, you're going to hammer them for it. But when you trust and invest, you create the conditions. Now, from a CEO's perspective, it's a little different. It's a little bigger. But the reality of it is you want to create the conditions for them to not only succeed and try new and innovative things. Hey, unless you think they're going to damage equipment or hurt people, let them fail once in a while. No one out there can tell me that we didn't learn our best lessons in life, much less professionally, by doing everything right. We did it by having the opportunity that occasionally we could make a mistake professionally, learn from it, pick ourselves up by our bootstraps, know how to do it better in the future, not get a chunk taken out of our rear end, but just ask the question, well, did you learn something from that? Yes, I did. good. Don't do it that way again. Let's talk about how we can do it better in the future moving on. Leaders need to give their people the ability occasionally to fail because it is the most powerful learning lesson you will have. And then the reason you train is because people must be professionally competent in their job.
When you were invited to speak at the prospective CO and XO classes and at the damage control apparently school up in Newport, what lessons learned did you carry to those folks?
Well, the biggest lesson learned I did wasn't really a lesson like, you know, I just went through those points. What I essentially did during those things, during those lectures, is, especially with the PCO course, is there were no slides. There was no death by PowerPoint. I just stood up in front of the class and said, look, you're gonna go out there and you're going to get the opportunity and the privilege to say the greatest three words in a naval officer's career. I relieve you. With those three simple words, you're going to carry out a tradition that has been in our Navy for literally two-plus centuries. And the reality of it is, the moment you assume command, it's yours. You are the accountable officer. And it's up to you to now lead and be responsible for your crew, train them, make them battle-ready, and take that ship into harm's way. And by walking them through the story and sharing with them some of the unique circumstances that I was put in as CO and the decisions I made and why I made them, and a lot of those are really laid out in the book, I think that telling the story had its own unique lessons learned that people could glean from it and say, okay, now I understand what command really means. I can learn about it in a book. I can read about it in our writings and everything else. But, you know, I just tried to convey from, you know, my experience alone. And it was a unique experience. I'm not saying it's ever going to be repeated, and I'm certainly not saying that I did everything right. But I'm saying, here's what I did and why. Here were the decisions I made and why. And you need to decide whether or not put in those same circumstances if you would do the same thing or you would do it better.
Well, I think, you know, Monday morning quarterbacks can give everybody a coronary, but I think the measure of everything was Nicole is, I believe you said, is doing her sixth deployment since the attack.
Yeah, I think you're right. I said fifth. I think you're right. I think it is the sixth.
Yeah, I think that is the bold and the underline on the performance of your crew and yourself on that day. And I wanted to come back a little bit to my first question here. Now that you know you're on the road and you're talking about your new book, which for anybody that's joined us halfway through the show, Commander Kirk Lippold's new book, Front Burner, Al-Qaeda's Attack on the USS Cole, where you can find links to both at the show page and also my home blog and other places. There are a lot, and I've talked to a few of them, quite a few people who feel, because of their experiences in the last decade and the rather thin amount of books out there on what we've experienced in the last decade during this long war with terrorists, they feel they have a book in them. But they're not writers. A lot of them are engineers and think on that side of the brain. But they have a book in them, and they would like to get the discipline to get that path going forward, to get a book out. What would be the first two things that you could plant a seed in their brain that might be a good catalyst to help them get that book that's in their brain onto the computer screen or the piece of paper in front of them?
Well, I will tell them right now that no book ever starts on its own. And the only way they can do it is pretty much like I did. Sit down at a keyboard and start typing. And it can be as little as a paragraph. It can be as much as 5-6 pages in a day on a weekend where it's a rainy Saturday and there's nothing going on, and you know, maybe you've got a break from the honey-do list at home that needs to be done, and you get an opportunity to start writing. But it's unless you sit down and make that commitment to type away And it does take an incredible amount of self-discipline to do that. You just have to fence that time. There will always be an excuse or reason not to do it. I mean, the chapter where I talk about recovering my sailors out of the wreckage, that short chapter took me almost 6 weeks to write because it was so painful to relive. But, you know, when you reach a point where you vacuum the house for the third time that week, all of yesterday's laundry is done again and folded, the refrigerator's full of food, and you've dusted the house for the fourth time, you don't have excuses anymore. Sit down and start typing. And the only way you're ever going to begin that long journey toward capturing what our Navy needs, which is the history of those who've lived through an experience and need to convey that for future generations, happens by sitting down and starting to write or type.
The one of the aspects of the book that I thought was interesting was the, other than the Tarawa issue, was the assistance you got from the other two warships that came to your, or actually three warships, the Brits, the and then the FFG and the other Burke class. Could you kind of talk about that a little bit, and what kind of leadership was demonstrated by that that help?
Absolutely, and actually, there was the HMS Manchester came immediately the morning after, offered us assistance. At that point, we were stable. Chain of command was reestablished. We were in good shape, and I told them thank you very much. And it was later that day that we had Donald Cook and Hawes, joined by one other ship that I have to make sure I raise, which was the USS Camden. And between those three ships, but especially Donald Cook and Hawes, when they walked aboard, I wanted to make sure from the get-go that we did not hide or sugarcoat, and that when their chiefs came aboard or their COs came aboard, we gave them a very honest, blunt assessment of where we were, what we needed, and how they could best contribute to do it, and then left it up to them between those two COs to figure out how to do it. And the volunteers that came aboard from their ships to help us out, let me tell you, they are the unsung heroes in this as well, because it was truly because of their effort that gave my crew the time and space to take that critical step back and decompress just a little bit to be able to survive those long 17 days in port. And without their help, I'm not sure we would have been able to survive that entire event. And so my hat's off to the crew members of Donald Hook, Hawes, and Camden for the phenomenal work that they did in helping to support, sustain us, and give us that critical, not just physical, but mental breathing room as well for the crew to be able to do what we did by staying on the ship for all 17 days.
Well, Kirk, I want to thank you a lot for coming in this Sunday afternoon to discuss not just your crew on the USS Cole, but also your new book, Front Burner, Al-Qaeda's Attack on the USS Cole. I would encourage everybody to give it a tumble. It's definitely worth your time, whether you're a naval professional or not. Kirk, what can we expect from you coming down the road?
Well, I think that, you know, I feel particularly blessed and lucky in life. The world is my oyster in many ways, and I'm still out there exploring and doing a number of things. The book is obviously keeping busy. I still enjoy going out there and speaking about the event, because being able to share with the American people what heroes we have walking in our midst on a daily basis is a wonderful experience. And then, you know, who knows what the future will bring? I mean, I had the unique opportunity of running for Congress last year, but events conspired along with a court decision against me. But there's always a future out there. So we'll see what the future brings, but I want to continue to serve my nation in one capacity or another.
Very well, Kirk, thanks a lot. Thanks a lot, yep. Kirk. Really appreciate it.
Absolutely.
And we will be keeping an eye open for you. We wish you and your surviving crew members and their families the best. And I want to thank everybody for joining us here for another edition of Midrats. And I hope you all have a great Navy Day.
Molly wrote on me to reply to. It's a long, long way to Tipperary.